This is Ben Lee in Quarantine, episode 5. And Ben Lee is still in quarantine, which means that he and I, Max Quinn, hello, have lots more time to get into lots more stuff. Yesterday, Russell Crowe sent Ben a DM, so obviously I'm going to ask about that. And then, saying huru to your guru. I'm so sorry. It was right there. I couldn't help myself. So how do you break up with your spiritual sensei? Big questions coming up right here on Ben Lee in Quarantine. Hi, Ben.
Hey, man. How are you?
Drinking water. Staying hydrated. It's good. How are you?
I'm good. It's my stepdaughter's 19th birthday today. So,
oh, no way.
We've had some celebrations. It's been actually fun. It's been one of the least, you know, birthdays can be kind of high pressure, especially like when they're younger. So I think she's appreciated how bizarre this birthday has been. So we ordered some Sydney fish market, some oysters and some champagne, and
lovely.
We had a carrot
That's
cake.
So nice.
Yeah, it was really good.
Can we do a quick sanity check? How are you holding up?
Pretty good, honestly. Like, we're still very much feeling the relief of, we actually just found that one of the families, we had a little pod in LA of basically four families where the kids would play together and we were all getting tested regularly. But we just found out one of the families, the grandpa, just tested positive.
Oh, no.
And so this was all, it was actually all, we weren't exposed in any way, but it really like reveals how fragile all these sort of arrangements are. Like it seems like he contracted it going swimming or something. I haven't been able to get to the bottom of it. But you know, for the sake of human sanity, you can't go 9 months with your kid not playing with other kids. So everyone kind of tries to figure out these types of arrangements, but they're all very tenuous. And it's really scary how, you know, it's almost like a security breach. So it's been another level of kind of just feeling the stress of what we've been living with for the last year and the relief
because it brings it even that much closer to home.
Yeah. And just the relief of kind of being this much closer to being out into the world and free of that fear.
Yeah. And the outside world here, I don't know how you are going to feel about it because it is so, like, I feel like going to the shops now, it doesn't exist, which is just, it's an insane thing. Like, I still feel like if I'm getting in an Uber or if I'm going to a place, I'm leaving my suburb, I'm wearing a mask. But you, I feel like, will be shocked by the amount of people who, when you go outside, will not be wearing a mask.
But why are you wearing a mask when there's, like, no community cases?
Out of over-hesitancy, I think.
Yeah.
Out of making sure and out of like wanting to do the right thing by other people and by my fiance to make sure that we understand that there's no community cases, but we're also in a position that like the what if is still scary.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Like we've lived with it as such a tangible, real threat where even when the numbers were like, you know, the government was like not wanting you to know as bad as it was, you still know because the hospitals were reporting and everything. And I feel pretty safe in Australia. Like I feel that the whether you agree or not with the government or whatever, it does seem like what they've done has worked. And I don't personally feel very exposed in Australia the way I did in the US for sure.
I bet. And I can imagine that feeling so different for you when you take your first steps outside and breathe in that glorious Haymarket air. Have you thought about what it'll feel like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that human beings are so remarkably adaptable, especially kids. So I'm kind of anticipating it'll probably be a very weird first 45 minutes. And then I even know, like, you know, you go to like a socially distanced gathering with masks, like say, three people meeting for a picnic in a park and catching up. And they get a couple drinks in them, and before you know it, everyone's edging closer to each other, and the masks are slipping down under the nose. And it's amazing how quickly human beings want to connect with each other and like
right.
relax and let their guard down. I mean, it really is. I think it's worth. I'm a full believer in masks. I've had a couple glasses of champers too. That's why I'm like missing some words. I'm a full believer in obviously masks and social distancing and taking, you know, appropriate precautions. But I don't think that precludes admitting how unideal and sad it is.
Definitely.
I don't like wearing a mask. No one likes wearing a mask. It's not a nice thing, but it is better than passing around a virus. So, yeah.
That's it. You know, it's like it's considering the alternative. And when you said the other day in the context of the presidential election, Thurston Moore's tweet about how it wasn't Biden versus Trump, it was me versus Trump. It's kind of the same thing, right? It's not wearing a mask versus not wearing a mask. It's wearing a mask versus spreading a disease.
Yeah, it just feels, I don't know, I'm pretty clear-headed on the pragmatism around that. But you can still admit things are hard and things, you know, it's been stressful for the kids. And, you know, there's something about the freedom that kids have to be boundaryless. That's one of the beautiful things about kids, the way they like jump all over each other and they don't have, you know, without it being like as adults, everything becomes like sort of sexualized and there's, you know, all these different like agendas we have around boundaries and stuff. And for kids, there's that beautiful innocence of them just like leaning on each other and touching each other. And that was one of the first things I found was it was like a sad maturing that was kind of happening to, you know, like I've said to Goldie, to my daughter, this is, you know, possibly the hardest. It's very possibly the hardest period you will ever go through in your life right now.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the upside is, hey, let's get that out of the way at 11.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you're on the up and up after that.
Oh, well, I mean, that's the dream, right? To not have your a traumatic adulthood and to instead deal with it at 11.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see. Who knows?
Yeah. How was Russell Crowe, by the way?
Oh, Russell has always been so, I really don't know him very well. I think we've actually met in person once, but he just reached out to me. He said, I'm in Sydney for a couple of days. Saw you in quarantine. Do you need any books dropped off or anything?
Oh my God.
Which I just thought was so nice. Like that's one of the things that has really struck me being back. The amount of people that like, not even like super close friends, but just people who have been like, do you need anything? Can I help? I don't know if it's a function of the sort of communal bonding of Australians or it's a recognition of the hardship of people outside Australia who have gone through much worse. I don't know what it is, but we've been so grateful for that, just the sort of welcoming back.
Have you needed any help outside of the like tangible welcoming?
Yeah, we've definitely had friends and family dropping things off and, you know, Woolworths delivery is fantastic. But basically, you know, we've been pretty self-contained. As I said, there's been a bit of a holiday atmosphere for us, just being free of stress, yeah.
We were talking yesterday about your moving in and out of spiritual spaces. When we left yesterday, I said that I wanted to ask you specifically about breaking up with your guru. And before we talk about that and the ramifications thereafter, I'm wondering if you can just sort of set the scene for me in terms of where you were on the continuum of your life when you realized that you might have been led astray by this situation and decided that it needed to end.
All right. Well, these things tend to escalate. I think where I was that, you know, me and my first girlfriend, Claire, we lived together for 6 years or whatever it was. So that was a very and we were very young. So that relationship, I think naturally there were sort of a lot of parts of us that weren't like fully developed yet. And I think for me, going on this big, you know, my own personal eat, pray, love or whatever it was, like, you know, like my own personal spiritual odyssey.
We'll call it a vision quest.
Yeah, vision quest. I mean, it was almost like my version of university. Like it was like I went through this process of individuation that at the time, like I've heard people talk about this before, like the first part of a human's life is about entering institutions and rising through institutions. And hopefully the second part of a life is really, it's essentially free of institutions. It's autonomous. And you can see that reflected a lot in even people's businesses. Like the ideal is people work for a company, they learn all the skills, they do whatever, and then they start their own thing or they, you know.
Go out on their own and do it.
Yeah, it's a very sort of, you know, archetypal journey. And I think for me, I was still, say at 23 or whenever that was that me and Claire broke up, I still had this very unfulfilled need to see, like, it's almost like how far I could push my own mysticism. You know what right. I mean? Like what happens if you, because it's like if you have those types of inclinations and you stay tethered to responsibility, whether it's a career or a relationship or family or tribe or religion, there's always this question of like, what if I just went all the way?
You know? Do you mean mysticism in terms of like the mythology of Ben Lee, of the persona?
No, I mean like the internal reality being the dominant reality.
I hear you.
So as I've now realized, that is actually incredibly problematic because it disconnects people from objective reality, which is how we find ourselves in. It's interesting. I'm reading a book at the moment called Hitler's Monsters, and it's about Hitler and the Nazi Party's connection to the occult and to magic. And it's really fascinating because it really talks about how something Jung recognized too, that Hitler essentially came from a shamanic form of leadership as opposed to like a chieftain type of leadership. Like people didn't really turn to Hitler for his expertise. They turned to him for his passion.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So he got people riled up through the cultivation of emotion and atmosphere, which is a shamanic path to leadership, you know? So anyway, so these are all the pitfalls, but back to the initial attraction to mysticism. As an artist, you're trying to sort of cultivate this internal space. And before the slings and arrows of criticism and fans and all that, there's this experience of how do I feel about the song I'm writing? Which is all about everything happening inside me, you know, not about how it's going to be received commercially or is it the right structure or what does the label say? And I think as someone that took on responsibility quite early in a lot of senses of integration with responsibility and interconnectedness and commercial art and all this kind of stuff, there was always this part of me that was like, what if I just let it all go and like really chased my own, you know, my own enlightenment, my own vision of mysticism, my own euphoria.
The feeling that you're getting when you're writing the song.
Yeah. The feeling of daydreaming.
Yeah.
The feeling of getting lost in, you know, can it also be like sexual? It's like the getting lost in your own experience without concern for anyone else, you know?
And you became pursuant of that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that spiritual groups are actually pretty good at doing is cultivating ecstasy. Whether you look at whether it's through mantra or music or breath or prayer or fasting, but basically these ecstatic atmospheres, it's almost like a realm of expertise that spiritual teachers and self-help gurus and stuff can do. They cultivate this atmosphere where you can either have sort of breakthroughs or have the illusion of having breakthroughs. Right. And if you know, I know for me, for myself, for instance, when me and Claire were breaking up, there's a lot of fear around that. Like a 6-year relationship from when I was 18 years old is like terrifying to leave, you know?
Sure. Hugely impactful.
Yeah. And my parents got together. My mom was 19. So in some ways, the model in my mind was that the person you meet at 18, 19 is the person you stay with forever, you know?
Yeah.
So leaving that relationship required a lot of courage. And I think the ecstatic experiences that I encountered in some of these groups and, you know, ceremonies, they almost gave me the courage to separate, because I felt an experience that was like internal to me, that was not dependent on being in a relationship. But the irony of it is, it then becomes connected to an entirely different dependency based on the group where you had it. And I think what I've kind of come to realize about gurus, and I feel this very similarly about pop stars and powerful people in general, that it's quite natural for human beings to have expansive experiences of consciousness. It's the most natural thing in the world, in a way. You look throughout history, throughout culture, it has always happened to poets, to regular people, to parents, to children, to, like, you look at the history of literature, it's people talking about expansive experiences of consciousness.
Emily Dickinson is just depressed and disassociating.
Right.
But, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but also positively, like Jane Eyre or Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. These are about people who began to perceive the world was bigger than what they had been brought up with, and took a very brave step into a bigger universe. And, you know, so it's an incredibly natural thing. And what I've kind of, what I came to realize was that what a good energetic vampire will do, and people do this in all kinds of ways, people, lovers do this to each other too, is they take full credit for the ecstasy that someone is experiencing if they happen to be in the same room as them. So if I cultivate, if I light the candles and I put on the music, and this room feels incredibly peaceful, right? Because I've put tapestries up, I'm burning incense. If you walk into it and feel a sense of peace, that's actually your peace.
Yeah, okay.
But if I want to be manipulative, I can convince you that I actually helped you create that peace, and I should probably get credit of it. And if you want more of it, and if you want it to go deeper, just stick with me.
Yeah, we can hang around and we can see where this goes.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I think for me, how I look back on, like, you know, the gurus I've met, how they work. They basically seduce you through creating an atmosphere in which you will naturally, quite naturally, have an experience of your highest ideals, highest self, highest longings, and then they take credit for it and they bound you to them. They bind you to them. And that was a long process for me of, like, going deeper and deeper into these relationships and rituals, chasing the dragon, kind of, you know, of those first feelings of bliss and feelings of well-being and feelings of confidence and psychic phenomena and that sort of thing.
And how do I get deeper into that?
I want more of that. Give me more of that.
Yeah. So how did you break up?
I think I mentioned it. I think I mentioned there was some work with ayahuasca in which I wasn't able to hide anymore from my own conflicted feelings. And it was quite a complicated ceremony that I did this one night where I just admitted a lot of things to myself. One of those was, and they were brutal things. A lot of gurus do a lot of charity. You know, so for instance, you might have a guru who, like, pays for heart surgeries for people that can't afford it. But then for that person who's in the room, they get the heart surgery and by their bed, they see a little picture of the guru.
Yeah.
Right. And I came to that night, I came to admit to myself that if you do quote unquote good in the world, but you do it with the intention of bringing people into bondage, into psychic slavery, it's evil.
Yeah, and so it's about the intent behind the good deed. Okay.
Yeah.
And so what happens next? Exactly. Are you having that conversation with the guru?
Well, no, this was all internal, right? So I went through one particular ceremony where I almost had to, like, it was almost like a chess game. I had to, I mean, people that haven't had experience with psychedelics will think this all sounds insane, but it's theater of the mind. So the mind will play out these scenarios for you like a dream where you'll get the deeper lesson through the symbolic nature of the, you know, experience. So for me, there was a very long negotiation, essentially for control of my own destiny back from this guru. Because what I realized is that, like, I'm not, I don't want to sound superstitious, like I believe that, like, oh, a witch doctor can steal your soul and then you, it's not like that. But if you give up power to somebody, they've got that power.
That's
I mean,
right.
Many people have done this with therapists, with boyfriends, girlfriends. It's like if you bow before someone and say, I surrender, tell me what to do, you know better than I do, that person becomes a figure in your consciousness, in your unconscious, and they do have control of your life.
That's why you see some of these cults ask for, what's the name of the thing where you give something over?
Collateral. Yes.
Well, yes.
In a sense, they're all asking for collateral, whether or not it's literal.
Right.
For some of it, it's the time that you put in. That's collateral. Because if you build an entire identity around a cult, you can't get that back. So in some ways, you're like better off to go. It's almost going like, it's not perfect, but let me keep working with what I've got. I'll keep building on it. And the lie goes deeper, you know?
Yeah.
But so in this experience, I had to become very certain that this wasn't for me. And like I was saying yesterday, when I think yesterday or the day before, we were talking about the sort of the innate anti-egalitarianism of the guru system, that it places one above others. It's an elite system. I think what I had to admit in these ceremonies was that I don't believe this is the path. It doesn't mean I don't believe amazing things can't happen in it, because they do. Every path has amazing things happen in it. I mean, there is literally, there is not one person on any spiritual path who won't tell you that they've experienced some kind of miracle or sign or coincidence or synchronicity. It's the nature of life. It happens. That kind of stuff happens. You had it happen around Adam Schlesinger's death. It was
Absolutely.
Not part of a spiritual path. It just happens. That's life.
Yes.
But you give full credit to the path. And what I had to realize was, I was like, I actually think I'm enslaved by something. And I don't want this for myself. And I did not debate this with the guru after, because that's like debating Pete Evans. You can't. There's no point. That anyone who's become a guru is too far gone in the sense of their own dedication to this elitist system.
So is the solution to ghost your guru?
Yeah, basically, ghost your guru. That's right. but it's what's interesting is, like, because I left, you know, I went through chapters of this experience, and what you find is, until you complete it, you just recreate it. So it began maybe with that driving teacher I told you about. I wouldn't have never called that person a guru, but you end up, like, this is my belief, that there is some kind of personal syllabus we each do have to go through. There's lessons we have to learn. And if you don't learn them in one place, they show up in the next place, and you just kind of got to deal with them, you know?
Right.
So for me, this idea of autonomy, real autonomy, independence, and it's funny because I'm an indie artist. I'm someone who, if you asked someone who doesn't even know my work very well, what are the touchstones of my career? I've heard people say this, he does whatever he wants. That's what people say about my career, right? So clearly there's complexity to that. Nobody's doing whatever they want. There are levels of which we're trying to, like, appease and please and, you know, all these things. But
levels to which we are bound by verse chorus.
Yes. But clearly this is a theme that was, like, in my path to deal with. What is independence? What does it mean to do your own thing? And what does it mean to take full responsibility for that? And I see it as, like, I'm kind of grateful for these experiences, because these were the dead ends that I walked down. I didn't walk, I hurtled down like a cannonball. These were the paths I went down in an attempt to not be autonomous.
And I don't doubt then that there probably were people within your communities who you were able to bring with you out of it, but you probably also brought them in. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, that is what's brutal. Because if you are like a, leader type person. And a look, I am like essentially as a front man, I'm in sales.
Yeah.
Like when I'm talking to you now, when I get on a stage, I have something I want to communicate. My job is, how do I get that across?
Yep.
You know what I mean? That is pure sales. Now, I think sales is a beautiful thing when you're genuine, and it's a devilish thing when you are trying to sell for the sake of selling. So there are people I sold, not through manipulation, but because I thought I genuinely had found something.
Because you believed it.
Yeah. And I did. I always felt part of the duty of realizing you were wrong is making yourself available to correct what you'd previously said. You know, it's like Salvador Dali, I reserve the right to contradict myself.
Yeah.
But you cannot ghost people that you've dragged into trouble.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I had a lot of conversations, and most of them I think didn't, I don't think most people left. I think most people like what they found. And I still have friendships, close friendships
with
those people. But I do, I have a kind of relationship where I can say, well, you know what? We disagree on this.
Yeah.
I think the path, what you believe is the path to liberation, I believe is the path to a psychological prison.
Right.
But we can agree to disagree. We can still be friends.
We can still be friends. Our kids can still play together.
Yeah, exactly. But I do not believe it's possible. I actually don't believe it's possible for one person to lead another person to truth. I don't think it's possible.
I agree with that.
I think there are times when through you expressing your truth, something might light up in me that goes, yeah, that feels right. That feels right. I want to carry a bit of that forward. But I don't think you led me there. I think in the act of me witnessing your authenticity, I tapped into my own authenticity. And tomorrow that'll be a different experience. But I think this idea of the elitist idea of sort of like a hierarchy, I just don't buy into it.
Well, so there's a responsibility, like there's a cap on the responsibility that you bear to other people in that sense, because if you are being your authentic self and they are breaking a piece of that off for themselves and finding what they love and what they want to believe in these spiritual experiences, the responsibility that I guess you have to them is to do what you've done and have those conversations, but you can't blame them for not wanting to leave.
The most powerful, most convincing, most just profound influence that any of us carries is the way we live our lives.
Right.
Telling someone what to, look, you see it with, you're not a parent yet, right?
No.
When you become a parent, if you become, it's like what you realize is that like you can tell your kid what to do until the cows come home, but it's what they see you do.
It's how you model your behavior.
Dude, that's where they're building their moral compass around. I there are times within my family, like me and my stepdaughter, I think I really damaged my relationship with her at certain points through my spiritual fanaticism. And after apologizing to her at different points, I realized that all the talk in the world about it was not going to do a whole lot. I had to become a different person, and I had to show that I'd left that behind. And that's the last several years of my life has been about that. And it works.
And showing where your priorities are in relation to your proximity to what damaged the relationship in the first place.
Yeah, and not doing it again. Like basically, like I think if you're someone who tends to get swept up in things, which I am, I think having some self-awareness around that so that when they see it happen, they're like, I can say, yeah, I know, I'm getting swept, I'm doing that thing. The self-awareness in that is incredibly comforting to people you love who have been damaged before through fanaticism, you know?
Yeah. Tomorrow, I want to talk a little bit about sales. I want to talk a bit more about psychedelics because it's something that I'm afraid of and I want to know what's there. And I think we'll leave it there. I'll listen back to this and I'm sure I'll have 100 more things to ask.
Sounds good, buddy.
Thank you, Ben. Talk to you tomorrow. Ben Lee in Quarantine is a collaboration between me, Max Quinn, and Ben Lee. I'm doing all the mixing and producing and editing and stuff. Sorry if you run into any pops or clicks or bung audio. I'm trying. Thank you to Ben. You can find him on the internet at Ben Lee Music. You can say hi to me at Max Quinn. We'll have another episode for you real soon.